This presentation of In Their Own Words is brought to you by The Honor Project and is dedicated to the brave men and women of the United States Armed Forces. Arguably, the biggest advantage the North Vietnamese Army had over the Allied forces was the element of surprise. Masters of the sneak attack, the Vietnamese crept through miles of tunnels that they had dug underneath the field of battle. To combat this subterranean enemy, U.S. soldiers armed with nothing more than a .45 caliber automatic pistol and a flashlight voluntarily dropped into the tunnels and crawled through pitch-black passageways in search of their elusive foe. This unheralded group of American soldiers, the so-called Tunnel Rats, infiltrated the underground web of the Viet Cong. C.W. Bowman went to Vietnam as an infantryman with the 25th Division in January 1967.
We heard about tunnels, and that was mostly from the old-timers that were already there. You know, they talked about, you know, Charlie popping up in tunnels and ambushing or setting an ambush and ambushing a squad or the platoon, and then they'd melt away in the jungle. You'd never find them, and what they were doing was going down in tunnels. First thing I went into was a big bunker. We were doing a S&D, a search and destroy mission, and going through a village. And they came across a lot of the people in the villages had bunkers underneath their hooches and stuff. And there was a particularly large bunker, and they said, okay, Bowman, you're the new guy. You know, you're going down in there, you know. And I said, well, you know, I don't know if I like this or not, but, you know, I was the new guy, you know, and I wasn't going to show that I was afraid to go down in this bunker, you know. I guess it was a macho thing, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But they gave me a flashlight, had a red lens on it, which actually you get down in a tunnel, you can't see anything with the red lens. But I remember having my M16 and that flashlight, and I went down the steps into the bunker, and it was pitch black, but I could see light at the other end, or where the other entrance into the bunker was. And I was so scared that I focused on that light on the other end of the bunker, and I had the flashlight in my left hand, my M16 in my right hand, and I walked towards that light. And there could have been 100 people in that bunker, but I didn't look left or right. And I said, all I need to do is make it to that light and I'll be okay. And I slow walked to that light, and I got out of that bunker. And like I said, if they found tunnel complexes and stuff, that unit or team would come out and run the tunnels. Whereas our unit, it was kind of like, you know, we found a tunnel, okay, who's going to run it, you know? And in this case, it was usually Gary and I ran the tunnels. And once you do that, then it's kind of like from thereafter, you know, until either, you know, you go home or something happens, you're more than likely going to be the one to run the tunnel. It was strictly voluntary basis. You didn't have to go in a tunnel. If you went in a tunnel and freaked, you never had to go back in a tunnel again. And you could do that real easy. I mean, you get down in a tunnel and start closing in on you, or you hear noises and you start shooting, and you can get cranked up real easy and lose it completely, and probably make you go insane if you're not careful. A lot of tunnels, you'd get into like a NBA base camp or base camp, and you start checking the bunkers out, but then you get down inside and the bunkers would have tunnels leading off of them. Sometimes if you were fortunate enough, you could find the entrance to a tunnel. Two of them we found was just by pure luck, because two NBA or two BC in one particular tunnel came out of the tunnel while we were there. They killed them, and then, you know, we found a tunnel where they came out. And that happened in two different occasions in the year I was there. But like I said, most of the tunnels were so well camouflaged. And I think they had specific rules and stuff, how to dig the tunnels, how to make their trap doors so they would fit. And once they closed that trap door, you couldn't even tell it was there. We would be in areas where you'd walk along and you look down and you see little piles of dirt all over the ground. Well, they would be digging tunnels somewhere in that area, but they would spread the dirt all out through the jungle. So they wouldn't have a pile of dirt somewhere. Yeah, a lot of trap doors were small. Most of your entrances, they were at angles and stuff. You'd go in and make a right angle or left angle, or you know, left turn or something like that. And that was mostly because GIs had a habit of just tossing a grenade in a tunnel and say, well, that takes care of that, but wouldn't do any damage. Because mainly the first section of tunnel, you'd go in, it would make a turn, it'd either drop down and make a turn, or you'd go in and make a right or left turn and go a short distance, and then there'd be a trap door going down. Mm-hmm. And if that was closed, you know, you didn't do any damage to anybody or the tunnel, unless for some reason they were in that first section of tunnel, concussion, get them, whatever. You didn't find them all the time, you know, they were so well concealed. Normally you wouldn't find them unless, you know, you were in like bunker complexes and stuff like that. Most of the time you were going through the jungle, humping the jungles, breaking brush, and you didn't run into tunnels, you know. I don't know, a few dozen, whatever. You know, not that many over a year actually, because like I said, they were so well concealed. I mean, we probably walked over thousands of them, never knew it. Especially in the Coochie area, that's where the majority of all the tunnels were in our AO, our area of operation, and that's the area that was noted for tunnels. The laterite or the dirt, the earth there, was so easy to dig in, but once the air hit it, the walls almost set up like cement, so they didn't have to use shoring and all that. They just dug the tunnel and. When the dirt dried out, it was almost like cement. So, I mean, and they dug away. And, well, they were digging since the French were there, you know, and they were fighting the Viet Minh down there. So, they've been digging tunnels for 80 years. So there was quite a complex of tunnels there.
Even those tunnels that seemed deserted posed a deadly threat.
We had to fight some spiders and some. We called them fire. Well, they weren't fire ants, but they were ants they had over there that could literally take chunks of skin out of you when they bit. And they would hang nests of those in there. And there was all kind of you know, things you had to watch out for in tunnels. I didn't run across it. You know, the one story was that they would take bamboo vipers and nail their tails to a board and hang it from the ceiling. You know, and you're going through there in the dark, and you know, and bamboo viper, we called it the three-step snake. You know, they bite you, you take three steps, and you were dead. But you had supposedly those things hanging down in the tunnel, and just different punji pits, false floors that you could fall through into punji pits. They had false walls in the tunnel where they. Could be on the other side, and as you're crawling through, they'd shoot you. One of the tricks I heard was they would wait for a couple guys to run tunnels, and when you went up through a trap door, when you stuck your head up through there, they'd take a steel or bamboo rod and run it through your neck and pin you there in the tunnel. And of course, it'd freak out the guy that was with you, and you didn't have to worry about anybody running the rest of the tunnel.
One tunnel that Bowman and fellow tunnel rat Gary Heater investigated looked like it had no exit.
Gary pulled the door off the tunnel, and I shined my light down there. I could see some ammunition boxes, but couldn't see all the way down the tunnel. So I told Gary I'd go first through this trap door. But the only way I could get through there was sit on the edge of the trap door and put my legs through, and then put my hands over top of my head. Like this, so my shoulders would be narrow enough to fit through. Never thought about how I was going to get back out. But anyway, when I dropped down, I had a pistol in my right hand, my flashlight in my left, and I just landed on my butt, shining it like this, you know, and luckily there wasn't anybody down there waiting for us down at the other end of the tunnel. So, and Gary came down behind me, and then as we got halfway down that tunnel, that's where we found that little escape tunnel off to the left. And that's where the picture came from, where they were, after we finished running the tunnel, we went back out through there and they took our picture. But we went down to the end of that tunnel and there was another trap door going up. So Gary says, okay, Bowman, he says, you went through the last one. He says, I'll go, He said, "I'll push up on this." He said, you shine your flashlight and hold the pistol there, you know. So I kind of leaned back in the tunnel and had my pistol and flashlight like this, and he pushed the trap door open, and nothing happened, you know. So Gary kind of stuck his arm up there with the light first, and then just kind of eased up, looked over the edge, and he dropped back down. He said, "God," he says, "there's a booby trap up there, you know." And so, "What the hell's up there?" He says, "I don't know," he says, "but it doesn't look good, you know." And we looked back up there, and I think it was a Claymore, a Chinese Claymore, was sitting up there on a tripod. I think it was just stored there, but you know, we didn't know whether it was booby trapped or not. But we had Claymores. U.S. armies were about this big, and a concave, had a pound of C4 in them, and had 250 ball bearings in front of that. And when you set it off, it throw out those ball bearings and kind of cut a path down through the jungle or cut people down or whatever. Chinese would make them about this big around and about yay thick, and they would be full of, usually, you know, they would take our duds, bombs and stuff like that, and disarm them and crack them open, take the explosive out of them and use that. And then inside of them could be anything, you know, rocks, glass, chunks of metal, whatever, but they would just blow a path clear down through the jungle, no problem. And this was what was setting up there, you know. So we both kind of eased back up there with the flashlight looking over the edge and realized, you know, it was just something that was stored up there, but it kind of scared the hell out of us for a while. And we crawled up there and we found, well, that and some weapons and a bunch of rice and documents, and we searched that room. We couldn't find any other trap door, and they're fairly well made because they were real experts in concealing these trap doors and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, you try to probe around or whatever and find it, but you know, you didn't always locate it. So anyway, we got everything that was in that room and hauled it out.
On one occasion, the darkness below the ground revealed a deadly enemy.
A couple times you could hear movement up ahead of you. And we didn't always run tunnels. I mean, as a team, sometimes you just went down by yourself. And I'd gone in a couple by myself and came into a room, and you know, I guess I might as well go ahead and say it. There was a lot of these, they had big rooms and stuff, and this one had like some bamboo beds. You know, they'd take bamboo and split it up and make beds and stuff, and there was two or three guys in there. They were wounded or whatever. I don't know whether it was a hospital or just a recovery area or whatever, but they weren't seriously wounded, I don't think. But anyway, they had like their weapons up against the wall and stuff, and I kind of stumbled in there. Really, when I came up in there and shined the light, you know, and boom, it was like Keystone Cops. They were there and I was here, and they started reaching for the weapons and I started shooting, you know. And when that happens, it's like it's just flashes, you know. Flash, this happens, flash, that happens. People hollering, screaming, people shooting. And when you shoot a 45 in a tunnel, you know, I think you immediately go death, because, you know, you holler, you scream, your heart's pounding. I mean, it's all reaction. You really don't think, you just start shooting and you want to get out. And you want to get out any way you can, you know. And running tunnels, you develop the ability to not think but shoot, because if you hesitate and think about it, you're the one that's probably going to die. So if there's movement or noise, you shoot. And that's what I did. I shot, you know, and get the hell out of there as fast as I could. And once I got out, you know, it was, you were alive, but you know, you were just so pumped up from all that, scared to death. And they say, you know, what's down there? What's down there? And you say, well, nothing, you know. And what I did is I took a charge back down and halfway down the tunnel and said, I'm going to collapse the tunnel, you know, and set the charge off. And I'm sure the tunnel wasn't collapsed or anything, you know, because once we got outside, you know, it just went boom, you know, it just shook the ground.
Sometimes the tunnels would yield valuable treasures.
Later on, we came across a bunker complex out in the Hobo Woods, and which was part of the Iron Triangle area, that our area of operations. And they found a tunnel out there, and I want to say it was Operation Manhattan or Fairfax or something like that. I can't remember. We found a tunnel, some tunnels down there, Gary and I, and Gary had, we went in the bunker. He found a shotgun and stuff, and I said, well, you know, we're finding some neat stuff, you know. And then we found a tunnel, and I guess it was young or whatever, crazy, whatever, but I said, well, there ought to be some neat stuff. Maybe we can find some souvenirs or whatever, you know. It was kind of that gung-ho, you know, you're young, you're not going to die, somebody else is going to die, the type thing. So we went in the tunnel, and tunnel wasn't that big. I forget how far we went, but we found a room. It was full of documents and stuff. Found a map. Map was probably, I want to say, about 2 or 3 foot long and about maybe 4 or 5 foot long. But it was in a tube, and Gary and I pulled that out, and it had a map of the whole area where we operated. It was Coochie and Tainan and Trang Bang, Saigon area. But it had, I think, 30 or 40 some overlays on it, acetate overlays, and it showed all the base camps, VC base camps, tunnel networks, and a bunch of other things on there. And it extended the operation like about 2 weeks. So all the guys in the company were pissed at us anyway, you know, because we had to stay out there in the jungle for a couple more weeks. But Gary and I were the ones that found that map in the tunnel. And there was a bunch of other documents. But for some reason, I wasn't as scared in that tunnel as I was in the bunker. I guess it was because the bunker was the first thing. But still, when you come out of them, you're pretty wound up, pretty cranked, got a lot of adrenaline flowing through you. So it feels good to be alive to get back out.
But for Bowman, just getting out of a tunnel alive was the name of the game. Bowman's fellow soldiers seriously doubted that he would survive his deadly duty.
Back then, I had a good sixth sense. You got to be real observant. Booby traps, any traces of somebody in there, luck, somebody was with me, the Lord was with me. That's who I have to contribute to now, you know. And over the years, you know, I used to fight and argue with him and wonder why he put me through those things, but evidently he had a reason. I resided to the fact that, yeah, he was with me, you know, even though during the time, you know, I used to say, you know, he hated me and I hated him, and it kind of balanced out. But evidently he had a reason. I still don't know what it is, but somebody was watching over us. And like Gary and I have talked over the years, you know, and both of us had made the comment, you know, we really never felt that we were going to die down in a tunnel. We got scared as hell sometimes. And sometimes it got touch and go, you know. Like that little shootout, you know, I probably ruptured my eardrum. I had blood in my ear when I come out, you know. The concussion down there from a 45 is tremendous. And we've seen pictures and books where the tunnel rats had 38s with silencers and all that. And we said, well, that'd have been nice, you know. But we just didn't have it, you know. And like in our unit, you know, it was, hey, you know, we need somebody to go in the tunnel. And we went, you know, and you took a 45 and you chambered around and cocked the hammer back and went in. So what do I test? We paid attention to what we were doing. We actually had no training on it. You know, it was just one day you went in a tunnel and they told you, well, watch out for this, watch out for that. So fear keeps you well alert. Being alert, being lucky, having the Lord watch over you, whole combination of things. So no special skill or anything. Or I guess maybe it was. It depends on who you're talking to. You know, and Gary and I were, you know, we were just a couple old G.I. Joes, you know, looked at as, I guess, a challenger or whatever, and stepped up to do it.
What was your reputation in the rest of the squad and the platoon? Those guys think you were absolutely crazy people?
Well, it took me 30 years, but I found another friend of ours, and he's coming down later today, Paul Frisbee. He hung around. He didn't run tunnels. But after I found him, I went to visit him, and we were talking, and I told him, I said, well, you know, I said, I had a hard time when I came back from Vietnam. You know, I said, I was a mean son of a bitch, you know, and just didn't want nobody around me. And he looked at me and he kind of laughed. I said, what are you laughing about? He says, what do you mean when you get home? He says, you were a mean son of a bitch over there. He says, the platoon and the squad were making bets on you and Gary that you wouldn't live through your tour. I said, what? He said, yeah, they were actually betting money that you weren't going to live through all this stuff you guys were doing. And I said, oh, nah, yeah. I said, you kidding me? He said, no. He said, I'm serious. He says, none of us believed that you were going to live through your tours. So I guess that's how they looked at us, that we were crazy or mean or whatever. You know, we just thought we, you know, I don't know, we kind of thought we were normal, you know. We weren't no heroes. I didn't consider myself a hero or anything like that. You know, I was just a grunt like the rest of them. You know, I've always, you know, the guys that didn't make it and stuff, you know, they were the heroes. You know, the guys walking around the Congressional Medal were awarded that. We had a Lieutenant Sergeant. He won the Congressional Medal of Honor. You know, he was the hero. We were just G.I. Joes, you know, doing our job. Vietnam was kind of war. It was a dirty war. It was kind of a situation where when you were over there, you just had to reside to the fact that you were going to die. You know, you probably weren't going to make it, so you were going to do the best you could and fight as hard as you could. And if you made it through, then you had to deal with the fact that you made it through. You know, but if you had to put everything else out of your mind, you know, family, friends back home, what's going on back home, you just couldn't think about those things because you had to concentrate on what you were doing over there. And that's kind of the way it was, you know. Put everything else out of your head if you're going to survive. And not everybody could do that. And certainly a lot of them didn't make it. So, but no, you know, we just thought we were doing our job, you know. I guess now we can think back, it was a hell of a job, wasn't it?
Gary Schooler, another willing tunnel rat, recalls his first impressions of Cu Chi, the heart of a vast tunnel network near Saigon, South Vietnam.
The first impression when you get there is, I know my first impression, got off the plane and walked straight to a bus. This is down at Binh Hoa, where I came in. And we got on the bus and started going to Long Bend, which is where we were going to be processed before we went to our unit. Well, first thing I know, we all noticed we got on this bus and it had chain link on all the windows. And we came across pretty fast that was to keep the grenades from flying through the windows as we went through town. The town of the people we're trying to save, you know. So there's this dichotomy right off the plane. He says that there's danger. It's not just out there in the jungle. There's people here who want to kill us too. And that kind of went against what we'd been told in our training back in the States. I remember seeing films that they showed us where we were trying to help these people defend their freedom and this and that. And so to get on that bus and see those grenade screens, you know, made me realize maybe there's a little bit more to this than we were told. When we got to Cu Chi, we were assigned to a unit. Our unit was out in the field. And basically what you do is fill sandbags and go to school. They had a mines and booby trap school there, which is probably the best thing they did for us because it made us at least aware. I thought the school was kind of stupid because they've got, unlike out in the jungle, you'd see wire, very obvious green, bright green wire or something, and a very obvious grenade tied to a tree over here. They were just trying to make a point, I think, but when you get out in the real deal, they weren't so visible. But it did get us to start thinking about the fact that there's more than just riflemen out there. There's other ways you can get hurt here. And they made it, by this time, I get there, like I said, 25th had been there since 66, and we got there at the end of 67, so They had quite a few experiences with mines and booby traps by that time. Those first guys, those poor guys that showed up in 66 with the division, they'd never seen one or even heard that term. I'd never heard the term booby trap until I got over there. So they're the ones that had to trip them and find them the hard way, and we were taught that, to watch out. And so that helped. We still had casualties from that, but probably not nearly as many as in the early days.
Let's go, Coochie Base Camp. Was it a city? Describe Coochie.
Base camps were interesting in that they were really small cities. I mean, they had their own water systems, own electrical generation. Coochie was one of the bigger ones, 25th Division. At one point, I believe it had 16 or 17,000 troops. That's a lot of people. Plus, they would bring in, when I was there, it was that big anyway, they were bringing in people from the outside, civilians, many of which were VC, I'm sure, to the tune of 3,000 or 4,000 is what I remember. But it would be huge masses of them at the gates every day coming to work. The Coochie base camp was, when it became evident that that Saigon was becoming more and more endangered by these creeping Kong regiments and so forth, the people down there in MACV decided to ring Saigon with these several bases 40, 50 miles out, and that would be like the first line of defense. And that's Coochie was in a strategic part of the Ho Chi Minh Trail where it came into to southern Vietnam through Cambodia and so forth. And it was just kind of like the main road. All roads lead to Rome sort of thing, right through Coochie to Saigon. So it was, that's the reason they put such a big base out there. Now, I wasn't there in 66 when they first went in, but I had friends who were. And when they went in and built, set this base camp, it was designed to put right, to be put right in the middle to obstruct the movement and the training and everything that was going on by the Viet Cong at that time. Those guys, they just showed up on trucks, and there were nothing but rice paddies and trees, and they had to form a perimeter, dig in, start building bunkers, and then later hooches. And the interesting thing about Coochie was it was built on a tunnel complex, part of the bigger tunnel complex, which I believe is something like 160 miles, they estimate, in length. And it goes for through half the AO of the 25th Division, but a lot of it happened to be right under the base camp. So originally, or soon, they started finding out that they were being shot at from within their own perimeter at night and things, snipers and things, and they finally figured out that people weren't coming through the wire, through the perimeter. They were actually coming from within the perimeter, didn't duck out of sight. So I think based on those early guys that were doing the tunnel business, it took them several months to clear out Coochie. And I'm not sure even how they did it. I know they collapsed the tunnels, they filled them up, they put concrete, everything. And eventually they worked the working tunnel system outside of the perimeter at least.
The tunnel rats operated in a zone known as the Iron Triangle.
There were three particularly bad areas along the Saigon River, which at that time carried a lot of sampan traffic, Viet Cong munitions and things. And the tunnel complexes linked them all together. The southern one was the Boloi Woods. There was the Hobo Woods, and then the Fiho rubber plantation was in that area also. There are others, but those were the ones to the east of Coochie near, along the Saigon River. And I would say the tunnel story part of the whole deal was probably 70% played out in that area. That was something that had been started. I've since learned, and they told us a little bit about this stuff, but even against the French, they had started building tunnels out there. So by the time we got there, they were pretty extensive and they were effective. And I think most people that were in that area knows the Boloi Hobo. And also across the river from there, just across the river, 100 meters, was the Iron Triangle. And that was a Viet Cong stronghold for years and years and years before we even got there. So that was also laced with tunnels. The Iron Triangle? It was 25th worked in there a lot, and there were, the 1st Division worked in there. And there was the 196. Several units went in there. 173rd was in there one time. But no matter who went in there, they never were able to neutralize that stronghold. And the Iron Triangle is actually, it was named by, I believe, a colonel who had, there had been an Iron Triangle communist base in the Korean War, and he picked up on that, and he named this the Iron Triangle. But it really is a triangle. There's the Saigon River, Titin River, and then Ben Cat, Ben Suk. These were villages that were razed during the war, I mean, just wiped out. Everything inside the Iron Triangle, if I have these maps, the old mission maps, and if you look at the old mission maps in the Iron Triangle, it'll give the name of a village and it'll have in parenthesis under it destroyed. Name of another hamlet, destroyed. Everybody was ordered out of the Iron Triangle around 1966. And it became a free fire zone, what we call free fire zone. That meant anything we saw in there that moved, kill it, because they're not, if it's a person, it's not supposed to be in there. The part about the Iron Triangle that amazed me was that it was kind of, I don't know why that would be a place the Viet Cong would pick, because you got this triangle with the rivers on both sides and really rugged terrain above. It looks, to me, looking at a map, it looks like it's sort of secluded and you know, like back to the wall sort of thing. And I think the Americans that planned these operations thought that too. We'll drive into the river, we'll do this and that. But they had one thing we couldn't handle, and that was the tunnel systems that would allow them to go down underneath all that. And when we started operating up there, it had already had several big operations way swept through there. They never were able to clean them out for sure, for good. And I personally think that was just a thorn in the side of America. I don't think it was that much of a, when, by the time I got there, there weren't that many Viet Cong in there, but I think it just bothered them that they couldn't clear it out, and so we kept going back and back.
Schuller recognized that the element of surprise was the NVA's greatest advantage.
I think what we noticed mostly was you'd be walking through an area, say, triple canopy jungle, and you're really thinking of jungle, you're thinking there's going to be a bunker over here in this hedgerow, and there may be a sniper up in this tree and that kind of thing. But though those things were there, most of the danger came from walking to an area that was infested with tunnels and what we call spider holes, just small, you know, maybe this big around, holes that these guys could pop up out of, take a shot, hit a guy in the back, pop back down. Everybody gets down, we find out we got a man down. Everybody do that, and you drag him off, get a dust off in there. Everybody says, where'd it come from? Some guy's looking over here, some guy's looking back here, but you can't see where it was. If you do see the guy, and you do try to mount some kind of assault to take him out, you may get to the hole and find nothing, because he's gone down, gone someplace 100 meters away, underground, pop up, shoot you again from the other side. So with that kind of strategy, it's easy to see where they can effectively control a company's movement. Two or three guys could, for a whole day. Now, I will say this, it seemed like we always got them eventually. Somebody found them, got a grenade down there or something, eventually. But we always took casualties doing it. And from their perspective, if they could take out two or three of us and only lose two or three of theirs, they were happy with that. They've said that many times. The original tunnel rats were engineers who were specialized in demolitions and engineering, all kinds of things like that. And they had the tough job of learning about the booby traps and the snipers on the ground, the snakes hanging from the ceiling, those kinds of things that they told us, they passed on to us. And it made our job a lot easier. They found these things. A good example is one of the earliest stories of bad things that could happen to the original tunnel rats was be going through the jungle, find maybe get a sniper around, crawl up, find a hole. A man would be lower down feet first, which sounds kind of unstable. We're talking about a hole, again, only about maybe 20 inches across. But you wouldn't want to stick your head down there first either. And the VC had developed a technique that I think they used against the French, too, earlier, where one man would stay at the tunnel, take a piece of bamboo, sharpen, and jam it through the midsection of the person coming down, all the way through to the other side. Well, this accomplishes several things. First of all, it puts this guy in a big hurt, and you cannot pull him out of the tunnel because he's got the bamboo stuck all the way through him. So it effectively seals the tunnel. The man has a chance to leave the Viet Cong. This is a very disturbing way to die. There's a lot of screaming, a lot of shrieking. It's not instant death. So it's demoralizing to the people. Tunnel rats used to tell us these stories. And we learned that they learn pretty fast. Don't ever go down a hole without throwing a grenade in first. Very simple, basic stuff. But sometimes you have to go through an experience like that to learn it. So by the time I got there in 67, in the 67, we had learned from these initial guys, and we would always take plenty of grenades. And you can get rid of anybody that's down there just by throwing a frag grenade down there. If it's booby-trapped, you know, one of their booby-traps, it probably will set off that booby-trap. So you're killing two birds with one stone there when you throw that grenade down there. Now, most of the time, there wasn't anything there. But if you did, if he was down there, it was going to get him. And just a very simple thing, just always grenade, you know, frag the thing first, and you would have a lot better shot of making it. But if we didn't know that, we probably would have done the same thing. Hey, there's a hole. Let's go get it, you know, fall down, same thing.
Now, your first experience, how did that happen? Why did you volunteer?
At that time, there was more of the defoliation going on, again, in '67. Tunnels were a lot easier to spot because they had three phases the way they got rid of these complexes, and mainly the forestation things up in Hobo and Iron Triangle, places like that. They would spray them, defoliate the thing, then they'd come in, burn them, you know, with napalm and so forth, and then the wrong plows come in and level everything. Well, by the time all that was done, you defoliate the thing, all these holes start popping up all over the place. And so there was just a lot more holes than there were tunnel rats, I think. And they figured out, well, we can't wait for engineers to come from, they're busy in another sector or something. So they would just say, well, anybody want to go down? And there's always a few of us that would. And I think we felt like we'd benefit from the first guys. We knew pretty much what to look for. And we were a little more cautious maybe than the first tunnel rats, just because there wasn't this sense of urgency to see what was the other end. We knew. But I went in usually behind somebody else and at the first. And my whole tunnel rat experience was compressed maybe in about 3 months, because that's the area we operated. That's the area we were operating during that first period of my tour. Later, after Tet, we moved back into closer to the Cambodian border, where there weren't so many tunnels. What we were looking for was, of course, these Viet Cong. There weren't very many Viet Cong up there at that time. They would hold you off with two or three guys. Eventually, you could neutralize them with different things. In fact, they tried while I was there. I remember several things were trying to knock out the tunnels. One of them was pumping water. They bring these big pumps, the size of a Volkswagen, big diesel pumps, bring them out by helicopter, Chinook, drop them by the river, connect tubes all the way, maybe 100 meters, 200 meters to the entrance to a big tunnel, and pump water, literally pump water all day and night for weeks into these tunnels. Well, it sounds good. It sounds like you're getting rid of the gophers, but we found out later that the VC had a way of sealing those things where the water wouldn't penetrate. And I think another thing they used to do was they would dig shafts, vertical shafts, as far down as they needed to get to a porous strata, and the water would just go out like a drain, you know, like a bathtub. So it was partially effective, I think, in the short term, but when they figured out what we were doing, they figured out a way to seal their tunnels. Their tunnels were in three levels, usually. So if they just sealed off the first level, that still protected the next two levels. Another thing they tried was pumping gas down, or CS gas. And CS gas is basically an industrial-grade tear gas used by the military. It's very strong, and they would pump it down in there and just try to permeate the different tunnels, air shafts, everything with it. And I do remember some Viet Cong leaving when we caught several trying to get out of there, get away from the gas. I remember that happening a couple of times up in the triangle. But for the most part, they were able to seal those off too. And one of the things we used to find in the caches down there we'd come across were gas masks, homemade gas masks, made of simple gauze, simple plastic bags and things. And they taped the gauze in there and wrap around their head, and that was their gas mask, and it worked. We had $300 gas masks that didn't work, the ones we carried, you know. So they were just brilliant at simplicity. That's about all you can say. They would take the most difficult problem you can imagine and apply a simple methodology to solving it, and they would always come with an answer. And so by that time, 67 and going into 68, I think the Americans figured out the only way they were ever going to neutralize them is just to destroy them. And they started carpet bombing B-52s. I mean, there were airstrikes in there all the time. You know, the F-4 Phantoms, during a firefight or something, come in, drop their bombs, they'd always leave a crater. But carpet bombing by B-52s is an entirely different thing. Anybody's ever been close to a B-52 strike can tell you it feels like an earthquake. And the first thing when you see one, by the way, I think B-52s are not allowed to bomb within 3 miles. They're not supposed to, within 3 miles of their own troops. That's how dangerous it is if they're off a little bit. Those guys are so far up there that you can't, they can't see you, you can't see them. You can see the bombs, you know they're up there somewhere, but they're so high you can't see them. That's the reason they're never shot down. But the first thing you would see is these flashes, but no sound. And then you feel the rumble of the ground. ground starts rumbling like an earthquake. Then the next thing, the last thing, is the sound finally gets to you. So it's like three stages there, you know. And it's really, really awesome. You can't imagine anything being in the path of that surviving. You just can't. You're talking about a swath. They would do that, and then they'd put us on choppers and run us up to the edge of this swath that might be 500-600 meters wide and maybe a half mile long. Or just craters, nothing but craters. But you can imagine that if there were tunnels under those craters, they couldn't withstand that. And that eventually led to, I really think, the abandonment of the tunnels in that 67-68 area time frame, because if you think about it, you got the level ground, let's say Hobo Woods, and below that 10 or 12 feet is the first level. And then you got these craters coming in, digging 20-foot craters. So you walk up on a crater, and you look at it, there's a hole on this side of the crater and a hole on this side. And so how do they fix that? I mean, even if we leave and they come back and want to fix it, how do they fix that? You can't go through that crater anymore, so do they dig around it? Do they dig under? I think it just became too massive an engineering problem for them to continue to keep repairing the tunnels once the B-52s got involved. And I mean, when you got up in the air, it looked like a moonscape down there. It was nothing but craters and flat ground and craters. And I think it's all well and good to have tunnels, but if you come up out of the tunnel and you're in just a bland moonscape where you can be spotted easily, it doesn't do you much good. So I think they started using more at night after that, and to store caches and things like that, but not to house armies.
For Schooler, the darkness of the tunnels was like no other place on Earth.
First thing I would say about the experience in the tunnel is this, and that is very few people, or at least very few sighted people, can imagine the total absence of light. And it's one thing to say the old cliche about you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. That's the only place I've ever been where it was absolutely true. If your flashlight was turned off and you were, let's say, 100 feet around the corner from your entry point, you literally could not see your hand in front of your face. And a lot of people think they've been in that situation, but they haven't. Anywhere outside in the country or whatever, there's always residual light off the atmosphere, off your radium, the radium dial on your watch, whatever. Down there, nothing. So all you had was your flashlight, 45 usually. You had to strip down because it's a very tight space down there. Take off your headgear, no helmet. It's not enough headroom for that. Radios were pretty unheard of. I've heard of people dragging radios behind them, which isn't very efficient, because they're heavy. Normally, you carry a radio on the back. There's not enough room down there for that. I mean, these are several things that are different from operating on the top. Say, walking point on top is walking point in a tunnel. In a tunnel, you have a compass, but it doesn't do any good, because to use a compass, you have to shoot an azimuth. You have to have an idea where you're going by looking at a map. You shoot an azimuth to that point using your map, and on the surface, for example, you pick out a benchmark. Maybe hopefully there's a tall tree there, or a pagoda over here, or something that you can get a bearing on. And as a benchmark, no matter if you have to go down the canal or back and forth, whatever, up over and around the hill, you still know where that tree is, and you know it was on your azimuth. Well, in the tunnel, that kind of reckoning doesn't do any good, because you shoot an azimuth in 20 feet. Maybe you want to go a point 500 meters to the north, shoot an azimuth that direction, but in 20 feet you hit a dirt wall. So what do you do then? I mean, the compass is useless. I mean, maybe you go to the right and back around. There's no way to pick up. There's no benchmark to focus on. So it's good to take a compass, because when you get out the other end, you may have to get back to where you came from, and you don't know. You just don't know whether you're going in circles or what down there. I was in a situation once when I first started going down, and there's actually three of us. This is during that time when we were finding a lot of these small 30-40 weapons caches, and I believe this was the Hobo Woods, if I recall. The lead man had done it a lot more than me. He was not an official tunnel rat as an engineer, but he'd been down more often than I had. And I was right behind him, about 10 feet behind him, 5-10 feet. And because of the visibility, you had to stay pretty close. Ideally, you wouldn't be that close together because of booby traps. But you can't lose sight of the guy either. You may get lost. So he's the only one that's got the flashlight. Then there was a sergeant behind me. And he was another 10 feet back. Well, we started going in there, and we got in pretty far, and we realized that this is just strictly exploratory. We were hot to trot that day. We thought we were going to find the biggest weapons cache of the whole company. We just, I mean, believe it or not, we actually thought like that, some of us, some of the time. I think part of that reason, that for that reason of thinking, that line of thinking, is that It's the only thing you've got to dang your hat on is how well you perform in that situation, how the other your peers, you know, accept that. And so there was some gung-ho stuff going on there. We must have been fairly certain that Charlie wasn't in there. I don't think we'd have been quite so anxious. But we were finding a lot of weapons, so we started going, and we got further and further in. We couldn't hear any noise from the back or any noise from the front. We figured out, well, you know, we don't want to get lost in here. And the problem was we started coming up on forks, you know, like two or three different tunnels. So we talked about it for a minute. We said, well, let's do this. We'll always take the right fork to the right. And if we hit another one, we'll take the right fork again. And then whenever we get to where we're going, wherever that is, we'll turn around and we'll take the left fork all the way back each time. It sounds good on paper, but it didn't work. And we got out there. We must have missed an opening or something. Something happened. We went down to a different level. We lost track. And so you're pretty much out there. We figured we'd crawl maybe a 900 meters. That's a long way underground on your hands and knees. That's chicken feet on top, but down there it's a long way. You don't know if you went down or how deep you are or anything. So we figured, we'll never find a way back because it was just honeycomb. So we just keep going the way we're going. There's bound to be an exit point at some point here. And I know during that time, we noticed the cutaways in the sides of the tunnel where people had been sleeping. And we're talking about maybe, dug in about 2 feet into the wall, about 6 feet long, which is plenty big for a Vietnamese. Every 10 feet or so, there's one of these little spaces cut out of the wall, a little enclave. And the Viet Cong were gone. Also on the walls, there were cutouts for oil lamps, things like that. So somebody had been using it for billets. There was one spot that was just alive with spiders. I do remember that. And the guy behind me wasn't particularly crazy about spiders. He was, you know, brave guy. He won medals for all kinds of stuff, but he didn't like spiders. And he was trying to get me to come back and clear out the path for him. The guy in front of me had the flashlight. He could see where he's putting his hands and knees and so forth, and he was just kind of maneuvering through there. We're only talking about, when I say maneuvering, we're talking about, you know, 2.5 feet wide. As for me, with no flashlight, it was just a matter of the crunching sound tells you you're in the spiders, and they get on your clothes and things like that. But I don't think they were bad ones because none of us got sick, you know. But nobody likes bugs crawling on, especially spiders. And this sergeant behind me, he was adamant, so I would go back every once in a while with my feet and try to clear a path for him. He'd keep following. We got a little bit further down. Meanwhile, you know, we're just trying to find an exit. That's all we're trying to do. We forget the weapons. We don't care about the glory anymore. We just want to get out of there. And you start thinking about could we be lost in here for a long time? Or maybe never get out. I mean, it's kind of crazy, but I guess it could happen. I heard this squeaking. It was up kind of around a bend. It got louder and louder, and just sounded like, man, I thought there were rats or something, because there were not other tunnel rats. There were real rats down there. And we got around this corner, and a guy shone a light around there, and it seemed like a million, I'm sure it was several hundred, bats just came right at us through this little, five-square-foot vegetable. You could see them from about, I don't know, 10 or 15 yards away coming right at you. And all you could do is just lay down flat, and you could feel the wings hitting you on the back of the head and on the back. And they weren't coming after us. They were just trying to get away. Unexpected things like that would happen to make it a memorable experience. The good part of that was it meant that Charlie probably was not in the area. If the creepy crawlers and the bats and the rats and everything had kind of taken back the tunnel, the Viet Cong were most likely gone. So I did feel some relief at that. We didn't know what we were going to run into. It seemed like we'd been down there 3 hours. Finally saw a little shaft of light off in the distance, and we, by this time, we didn't care whose light it was or what it was. And we went to it, and it was a well. It was from the outside, it looked like a well, but it had kind of a foot steps carved into the side of this clay, and you could put your feet on both sides and work your way up. Pop out of the ground. Again, you don't know if you're right in Charlie's backyard or you don't know where you are. We had no idea how far we'd gone or what direction. And it was in the middle of a clearing. It was just jungle on 360 degrees all around us. So then you pull your compass out and you know where you came from, so you can shoot an asthma and go back. Then all you have to worry about is either walking through Charlie's territory or your own guys popping you as you walk through the jungle towards them. So you try to, you want to call out, say, hey, we're coming. Alpha coming, you know, this is Alpha coming. We're coming, so don't kill us. as we walked through the hedgerow, were not Charlie, but of course, Viet Cong can hear too, and they could be there. So that's kind of a touchy situation, whether it's coming out of a tunnel situation or out of an ambush patrol or anything. You always have to remember that when you return to your lines, that's very dangerous, especially in a free fire zone like that. So that was a rather uneventful half a day that really produced nothing except some stories. And I talked to those guys every once in a while, and I still remember that day that we went so far and we got lost. And I'm just glad somebody dug a well where it was, because we were running out of gas.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by
law. See terms and conditions 18+. The Viet Cong used the tunnels to stockpile weapons for their massive Tet Offensive in January 1968.
Well, at that time, when I spent most of my time in tunnels, those 3 months leading up to January 31st, which was the beginning of the Tet Offensive, we were finding, again, the defoliation had started in a big way. We were finding a lot of tunnels that we'd never seen before because they were covered with the jungle. And we were finding all these caches of weapons. Well, we never realized at the time, because nobody knew about this Tet thing, or at least they didn't tell us. Nobody knew why were all these caches out there, and why all these supplies, for what? There's nothing out there, you know. It's the Iron Triangle. It's a raised, it's a desert. It's a moonscape. What is all this stuff doing there? January 31st, when the Tet Offensive hit, it all became clear, because that was a staging area. The troops moved in there in something like 2 or 3 days into through the tunnels. They picked up their weapons, all their gear, and all this ammunition stuff that had been stockpiled. I'm talking mostly about the 9th Viet Cong Division, which was a big-time hardcore main force VC. They'd been around for years and years. 271st, 72nd, 73rd regiments, which we wiped out time after time, and they always came back. There was always plenty of people to fill the ranks, and they're very disciplined fighters, and when you think about it, what's their home ground? Those guys were all from that area, so it's kind of like somebody comes to your hometown and starts walking through your vegetable fields and things like that, and raising the village. You're gonna be more aggressive probably fighting him than you would going off to a foreign country. So these guys were very dedicated and very, very good, and they set this up. NVA joined them, coming down from the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They got these weapons. They were able to crawl within just a few miles of Saigon. And this is the kind of northwest sector. The northern sector of Saigon, anyway. And then it became clear after that, after this massive assault on the capital there, that these guys had been planning this for a long time. That's what all those little caches of weapons were about. That's why we didn't encounter a lot of large scale stuff out there at that time. I think they wanted to draw attention away. They didn't want to draw attention to that area because they were staging for this big assault. Now, the interesting thing about that was that in that assault on during Tet, for that first week or two, on that part of Saigon, was almost all the 9th Division. Almost the entire division was wiped out. We just had too much firepower, and they underestimated that. They've since said that. But so the people that got wiped out there were kind of the caretakers. They were the developers, the protectors, the caretakers of the tunnel system, that 9th Division and units from it. And they were just skeleton crews after that. I mean, instead of 20-man cells protecting a certain part of the tunnel complex, they were down to 2 or 3 men. And that was kind of the beginning of the end for the tunnels. There weren't enough people to fix the damage. I'd say we went up there a few times after Tet 68, but they were pretty empty. It had served its purpose. If you go out there now, they'll tell you that, I mean, the Vietnamese have made a theme park, a wartime theme park, and they'll tell you that the tunnels were effective right up to the end of the war, from 66, 65 up to 75. It's not true. It was pretty much between the B-52s and the attrition during Tet on the Viet Cong, that was pretty much the end of the story for the tunnels.
For Schooler, the hardest thing to control was his own fear.
This is probably going to sound pretty hokey, but I think that the guys that went down felt like they're doing something that not very many people could do. And some people force themselves to and I'm talking about bravery even. I'm talking about just sort of a confidence and sort of a youthful, macho approach to life at that point a lot of young guys have. And you know, the tunnels are terrifying to some people, claustrophobic people and so forth, and other people they're not. I will say this, that the most, well, every guy that went down was afraid of something. Like a sergeant I told you, he was afraid of spiders. He didn't care about Charlie, but spiders bothered him. I've heard guys say they had fears of rats, other things like snakes. Snakes was one of the things they used to booby trap tunnels with. They'd suspend them from the ceiling. You walk through, I mean, you crawl through in the dark and bump on the head and they strike it. I mean, that's the intent. We saw some dead ones. I never saw a live one, fortunately. But for me, and I'm not, I think I came out of the whole thing fairly unscathed psychologically, but for me, there's one thing that will give me dreams, and I've had dreams about, and that is the thought of being buried alive, of being trapped underground, not being able to get out, and your air slowly running out. And I never quite overcame that. That one always bothered me. I was worried about explosions and things like that. Fortunately, that was pretty solid ground there. It was a type of clay that's pretty stable. But still, sometimes you're crawling in those areas that were narrowed so that only Charlie could get through, or he thought. We would actually go through those, and you could actually feel when you expanded your lungs, when you took a breath, you were kind of wedged in, so you exhaled so you could have a little bit better maneuverability through there. Now, if you can picture yourself being stuck, if there was a cave-in or something, I can't imagine a worse way to die. I'd rather be shot or blown up or something, but the idea of being stuck under there with no running out of air, it's that slow death. I have awoken in the middle of the night in a cold sweat thinking about that. I've never had bad dreams about Charlie. I've never had bad dreams about snakes and the other things. But that one got to me a little bit. And I would say every guy has something like that different, you know. There is some fear, and I think it's the idea that you can overcome that fear. It's a great feeling. There's nothing like combat's where it happens most often. There's nothing like going through that kind of thing and winning. I mean, bad things can happen to you, but if you come out ahead, you got something to be proud of, I think.
The enemy's resourcefulness earns Schooler's respect.
Viet Cong were great at making use of whatever was around. For example, everybody's heard of Ho Chi Minh sandals. Those are simply footwear made out of truck tires with the inner tubes cut up to make straps. Good for 50,000 miles or 1B-52 stride, we used to say, but they were effective. And they had nowhere to go get supplies. They had to do it all themselves, as opposed to our situation where we were resupplied every day, every evening, really, with ammo, whatever we needed, food and things. So they had to pretty much carry what they needed or stockpile it, carry it and stockpile it and come back to it. And that's one of the things they used the tunnels for. They had stockpiles of stuff everywhere. It was very common to find a small tunnel entrance, explore it, and find a cache with maybe 30, 40 weapons. And I'm talking about brand new AK-47s, usually bathed in grease and wrapped in plastic. And they would just put them in a little cutaway inside the tunnel and just leave them there for future reference. Now, and along with the munitions with it. And one of the things that we didn't realize in November, December 67 was this Tet offensive was going to happen at the end of January in 68. So we started finding a lot more up in those areas like the Hobo Iron Triangle, which were staging areas. We started finding a lot more of these little caches. And people wondered, why can't we find the big one? You know, the one that's got thousands of weapons in it or whatever. And I think what they thought was true, that they needed to spread it out so that one lucky find didn't immobilize the whole project. So I think we started finding that quite commonly out there. And some of the things you'd see that were amazing was, and usually from the stores, stuff they'd store. They made it from our napalm canisters, for example. We use all their silverware, their dishes and plates, their... They would take, I found grooming kits. These guys would take a piece of metal from a napalm canister and file it down and make a comb out of it. Straight razors, things like that. And you think about it, there's no Walmarts out there, and they probably will be someday, but they would take that stuff and just, they were great with their hands. They would always do a little artwork on it with a girlfriend's name or something on it. And that was kind of the way they passed their time, I'm assuming, because there was an awful lot of that stuff. As far as the munitions, I think the failure rate in Vietnam was something like, it was only something like 4%, like dud rounds. But when you're talking about millions and millions of tons of bombs, that's a lot of ordnance that didn't explode. They're still finding it every day now. They would take that, and if they could break it apart and take the powder out, then they could make, you know, take one 155 round and can make 10 booby traps with the powder in that thing. But think about it, that's kind of a tricky job. You've got to get the thing open, get the powder out without blowing yourself to bits. And my understanding is that a lot of people were, quite a number were killed doing that. They had a way of accepting that kind of death as being part of the overall fight, and they would just put up with it. But, and I've learned that Thai. I know some Viet Cong from recent trips over there. And they would talk about those kinds of hardships, but they were taught from an early age that they had to put up with it. The nationalist effort that they were, in their terms, revolutionary effort, was worth the death to anybody, wife, son, whatever. So they were doing things like touching this ordnance and stuff that we wouldn't think of. Well, when we would find unexploded ordnance out in the field, we would just approach it cautiously because it could be already booby trapped. That's another thing to do. They would take a piece of our ordnance, put a small piece of theirs underneath it, wait till we get close. They had trip wires. I mean, they had either trip wires or electrical detonation devices that would blow these up. It's one thing for a grenade to explode next to 4 or 5 minutes, a whole different thing for an artillery shell. You know, 105 millimeter or 155 was common. That takes out the whole platoon, anybody that's close to it. So you had to watch out for that. But when we would go up to them, we always had engineers with us. We had a lot of demo, a lot of C4 plastic explosive. And we would just lay the plastic explosive and blow it in place. You back off, have a fuse, get, you know, hide, get down and blow it up. And this can take a considerable amount of time when you think about it, if you keep running across these. But the danger of leaving it behind, just going around and leaving it behind, is that Charlie will get it and he'll make it into a mine, some kind of a mine, I get to be used against you at a later date.
Chaos reigned when the Viet Cong popped out of the tunnels and attacked.
I remember one time we were in a fight and for a little firefight, we took about 3 or 4 casualties, and these were guys that were in the tunnels in spider holes, popping up, shooting back down the tunnel. I went up with, we didn't know exactly where they were coming from when we first took the casualties, so I sent myself and 2 men up to see if we could locate the sources, the closest one anyway. And sure enough, we saw the guy standing there. And immediately, about the time we saw this individual standing in the tunnel with his AK looking around, he saw us, and almost simultaneously, some shooting happened from further back, another spider hole. The 2 guys, the one in front of me and the one behind me, we were just like just 3 stooges, real close together. Both dropped just like that. We all dropped because the bullets were flying, but both of them were hit in the initial burst. And we all managed to get back. They crawled back, and I grabbed their weapons and crawled back too. We had seen the one guy. He wasn't the one doing the shooting. Anyway, it was determined that we need to go up there and get those guys. So I was the logical participant because I knew I had seen the guy going out. I was the only one who knew where it was. And so I agreed to do that. And I went up there. I wasn't going to make the mistake that I'd seen before, I described before, of looking down in there or anything like that. I just had a grenade ready. And I climbed up on the top of it. I knew he was probably right underneath there. And I popped a grenade, and what we used to do, what we call cook off. We'd let the grenade cook off because it has about 4.5 seconds. Once you let go of the handle, you got 4.5 seconds and then it explodes. You let it go, you can hear that thing go pop. You know, in your head, you're going 1,001, 1,002, 1,000. And that was my cook off. I was willing to let go 2.5 seconds because 4.5 seconds long, if the guy's standing right there and you throw it down, just let the thing, you got 4.5 seconds, that's plenty of time to pick it up. Basically, it would probably blow up in your face. And you think about it, that's really all Charlie can do. He's a dead man if he didn't get rid of that grenade. So he's at least going to try to throw it back out. And if you're laying on top of the hole, right beside the hole, it's going to blow up right here. So I was more worried about that than I was a premature detonation on the grenade, which I've seen some of those go pretty fast too. But, you know, pop it, 1,001, 1,002, 1,000, and then throw it hard with English, if possible. You don't want any ball players down there. Made a great catch and throw them back up. So throw as hard as they could. If you can bounce it off some walls in there, great. And then, of course, you cover up, lay down flat. And I'm hearing this explosion. Kind of pushed me off the ground a little bit. And I looked up and smoke and dust and everything. And laying right in front of me was this AK-47. Beautiful rifle, brand new. Except the stock was all messed up from the explosion. It was just laying right in front of me. It must have been blown out and hit the bank on the other side and didn't come back because I was not over. I mean, somehow it came back. That was you did the right thing and here's your trophy. I was amazing. But it did tell me that he was right there. I mean, he had to be real close to the entry there. And that would have been one of those deals where if you just crawled up and looked in there, yeah, I'm sure he had his finger on the trigger. So those kinds of things. Actually, I experienced that something like that twice that same day from the other spider holes. And the people behind me were watching, were close enough to see what was going on. I think some of them learned a little bit just watching. I mean, OJT is the best teacher, but if you can have somebody in front of you that's done it a couple of times and watch them, then maybe it's your turn next time. Yeah. And that's it was just kind of the mantle was passed down to the younger guys.
From his experience in Vietnam, Schooler acknowledges that it took a certain breed of soldier to volunteer for the deadly duty of a tunnel rat.
Some of us were somewhere in between sanity and that real adventurous spirit, but we would see guys that we trusted and that really had looked up to because of their actions and the way they handled themselves and under stress. What being cool was really about. When you see a guy like that and he's the one that's leading you, you want to be like him. And so I think some of us fell into that group. If he's doing it, I'm going to do it, And then others, that's probably the two main groups. There might have been a few guys that just didn't know any better. But I think that the true rats, the guys that went down day in, day out, they had this feeling of superiority, in a sense, over people who just wouldn't touch it. And the fact that it was voluntary tells you a lot. I mean, there's not too many things in the military that are voluntary. But they knew they weren't going to have much luck asking guys to crawl down in 2-foot-wide holes looking for an armed enemy or booby traps or whatever. So they asked us, and some of them said, okay. I wouldn't want to do it for a year. The tunnel rats that taught us, the original ones, those engineers, that's all they did day in, day out. They finished this tunnel. No relief. They get on a chopper and they go to another one. And they get on a chopper and go to another one. Whoever survives that one. And I just can't imagine lasting a year. In fact, I think most of the ones I've talked to were either injured or something like that or broke down psychologically. Ours, because ours was mixed, with part-time tunnel rats, part-time point men. None of those are great jobs, but there was a little bit of diversity there. To follow up on that, there was a lot of boredom out there. Some guys can go 2 or 3 weeks without actually seeing anything, any kind of action or anything, or a month, and they'll do anything to just feel like they're part of the, what are we here for? We're supposed to be after Charlie. So I think there's a little bit of that eked into it also, boredom. A lot of people don't think of war as being boring, but it's about 90% boredom and 10% sheer terror. So you have to balance the... that boredom will bring down the morale after a while, particularly in those areas like the Hobo and Iron Triangle stuff, which were heavily booby-trapped. That was their main modus operandi, you might say, as far as doing damage to us. When you're taking casualties every day, even if it's just one or two, you're walking along, you hear an explosion, you hear a guy screaming, you find out two guys got hit, one killed. Okay, that's all that happened that day. Tomorrow, or maybe 2 days, same thing happens, another area. Or maybe the same area. It becomes demoralizing, and pretty soon you just are chomping at the bit to get at the enemy, payback. And once that kicks in, all these things, you got to remember, we're talking about minds of 20-year-olds, 21-year-olds, and all that stuff starts cooking, and you get some pretty aggressive people, sometimes over-aggressive.
We hope you've enjoyed this presentation of In Their Own Words. This program was created and produced by First Person Productions in association with the Documentary Broadcasting Company. The stories told herein were supplied by the Honor Project. Produced by David Benson. Content written and produced by Dave Barsky. Engineered by Greg Bartheld and Brian Donovan. Narrated by Bill Ratner. This production is copywritten by First Person Productions, Incorporated. Any unauthorized broadcast, public performance, or copying is a violation of applicable laws.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.